Heard about Magpie, the vegan pie truck that needed a bit of help from GoDaddy. One day the owners are like, this business hasn't reached its potential. And the other one goes, we need a bigger piece of the pie. And then it hits us. We need GoDaddy. Look, we can get a domain name and create an online store so we can sell to more customers. Now they've gone from serving a couple of pies to flogging nationwide. And now everyone's like,
vegan pies are the new thing around here.
Wait, no meat. For the help and tools you need to grow online, GoDaddy.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Welcome to episode 710 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, June 27th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster, a little bleary-eyed after last night's Dynamite stream. Had a lot of fun. I want to thank everybody for hanging out with me last night on a rare Saturday night sound off. Final AEW Dynamite out of its normal time slot. I am very, very happy it is going back to Wednesdays. Starting this Wednesday, in fact. There'll be another Dynamite here in a few days. But we had the big AEW Championship match last night. Kenny Omega defending against Jungle Boy. So the full review is up. I'll talk about that here just a little bit here in a second. But the full review is up on the YouTube channel if you didn't join us last night, if you missed it. If you were one of the cool kids and you were out doing stuff on a Saturday night. But we're going to talk about that. We have a lot to get to here this week. There is a gigantic amount of history that is condensed into this one week. So many more things than I even imagined. So we got a real fun history segment coming up later on in the show. Obviously, we're going to talk about these WWE cutbacks this week. Even more people. Another bloodbath this week. And some controversy around a WWE writer that was fired. I know a lot of you have been wondering my thoughts on that, so we're going to get into that. Edge is back. He returned on SmackDown this week to attack Roman Reigns, which has not made Seth Rollins very happy. So we got a lot to get into, but I want to thank everybody for your continued support. Keep using our Audible link, by the way. That is still active, and you can try the service out free for 30 days when you use the link audibletrial.com/solomonster. Get yourself one free audiobook of your choosing. There's a lot of really good ones up there from all kinds of wrestlers. Daniel Bryan, Steve Austin, the Young Bucks, Bob Holly, Justin Roberts, Jim Ross. So if you're looking for an audiobook, a wrestling audiobook, you can get it for free with our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. And if you'd like to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to thank these fine folks here in Roll Call this week who make all of this possible, including the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills. I hope Michelle is having a great weekend. I want to thank her for her very generous support this week. Night Stalker Naif Al-Safar. Saw Naif pop up in our chat last night on YouTube. Big Bear Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Last Man Standing Al Alvarez, Ostentatious Alan Carter, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, The Wichita Workhorse Clayton Nettleton, John Raging Mad Riffle, The 90s Vampire, Eddie Valens, Michael Maximum Payne, Palkowski, The Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, Vicious Vincent Cooper, Belt Fan, Brent Banner, of course, of the famous How Did We Even Get Here podcast, The Pastor of Pain, Damian Ewell, and That's a Fact, Chris Foster. Check out his latest video on YouTube, What Comes After Generation Z. You can check it out on his website, Faxma. F-A-C-T-S-M-A, Faxma. Check out Faxma on YouTube, where it is always good to ask questions. It's never a bad thing to ask questions. I ask questions here on the podcast every week, especially usually it's after I watch Monday Night Raw. I usually ask myself why. I still don't have any answers, but if I ever figure it out, I'll let you know. Thank you to our new YouTube members who joined this week. We have a couple of membership tiers on the YouTube channel. Everybody on there gets access to the exclusive Sound Off Discord, and there will be more retro audio going up this week for our top tier, our Legends members, so please consider if you'd like to check that out. You'll see the join button on our YouTube channel pretty much under any video, or on the main page. Just click it, it'll give you all the information there. And one last plug, and I'm really excited about this. I told you guys about this last week. I broke the news that the next Wrestle Rumble contest, the big giveaway coming up in the month of July, is the custom Solomonster Championship belt. There have only been two of these made. I own one. One of you is going to own the other one. And as of right now, those are the only ones that exist. And it only costs you $1 to enter. $1. Go to WrestleRumble.com. You can enter as many times as you want. One lucky winner will be randomly selected by yours truly during my live Money in the Bank pay-per-view stream on July 18th. This thing is a beauty. So go to WrestleRumble.com and get in on that contest right now. Now, I mentioned Dynamite aired last night. The penultimate show from Daily's Place in Jacksonville, the final one, will be on Wednesday. And that'll be highlighted by the Young Bucks, non-title against Eddie Kingston, and Penta El Cerro Miedo, where if they win, they get an AEW tag team title match, and MJF goes one-on-one with Sammy Guevara. I thought the Kenny Omega Jungle Boy main event last night was fantastic. In fact, I thought the show opened really strong, and it closed really strong. And there wasn't a whole lot in the middle that was really off the charts or anything like that, outside of the, I thought, the segment with Conan and Tully Blanchard, which I enjoyed. But, you know, given the events of the main event, obviously Kenny Omega still your AEW World Champion. I don't know that anybody really honestly expected Jungle Boy to walk away with the title. But Christian Cage made an appearance at the end there and was mixing it up, chased Omega out of the ring. And at some point this summer, I don't know if it'll be at All Out in September or it'll be a big Dynamite main event on TV one week, but at some point this summer, we are going to get an AEW title match between Christian Cage and Kenny Omega. And I think that could be a fantastic match. I look forward to that. The stuff they're doing with Christian and Matt Hardy, I'm not a fan of at all. Doesn't do anything for me in the least. But if you did not see the main event last night, I encourage you to go check that out. And even the opener with Hangman Page and Powerhouse Hobbs. Conan and Tully Blanchard had a face-off in the ring because Tully Blanchard there on behalf of FTR. Conan there on behalf of Santana and Ortiz. Obviously, these two teams are going to be having a match very soon. And Tully is good. I mean, Tully is always good on the mic, but Conan was on fire last night. I was talking about this on the stream. You know, he's had a whole bunch of health issues. His other kidney's having, you know, issues with that now. I know he had a kidney replacement many years ago. He's still having kidney problems. He dealt with COVID that hit him pretty hard because of his pre-existing medical issues. So to see him up and around and taking a fucking bump, which shocked the hell out of me. He took a stuffed pile driver from FTR in the middle of the ring at the end of the segment. But he was spitting fire on the microphone last night. And it was kind of funny recapping in verbatim, you know, hearing me recap the promo. So anyway, that's all part of the full review. It's up on the YouTube channel. As I said, Dynamite is back on Wednesdays this week. And then they hit the road, July 7th. First show on the road in Miami. Well, I mean, on the road. I mean, they're still in Florida that night. They're going from Jacksonville to Miami on week one. Not a huge trip. But the point is, they will be out of Jacksonville. Now, the top story for this week. Earlier this month, after the last round of WWE releases, there were rumors that there would be more coming. Andrew Zarian of the Mat Men podcast kind of teased it. He said he was told as much. He just didn't know which day the next shoe would drop. Well, that day was Friday. Usually Friday is the day where you do like a news dump if you've got bad news of some kind Friday is usually the day that kind of stuff happens. 14 wrestlers in total lost their jobs on Friday. All of them tied to either the NXT brand, the 205 Live roster. Of course, with some of these guys, they were on both. There's some overlap there. As well as one writer. And I'm going to get to her in a little bit. So 15 people that we know of in total lost their jobs on Friday. This as WWE continues its string of budget cuts led by Nick Khan. So let's go through these names. There were no major shocking names like last time with Braun Strowman and Aleister Black, who had just been brought back to television. I mean, that was just head-scratching. Nothing on that level this time, but there were some longtime names who are no longer part of the company. Fandango and Tyler Breeze, both members of Breezango, were let go. Johnny Curtis, he's been there forever. I mean, his name is really not that surprising. He's also dealt with a lot of injury issues over the past few years. Honestly, neither of those names are surprising, given how they were used. The Tyler Breeze cut makes me sad because I was a big fan of the gimmick when he first got over on NXT. And he will forever have the distinction of being Jushin Thunder Liger's opponent in his one and only WWE match at NXT TakeOver Brooklyn back in 2015. Unless you count the Wrestling Summit in Japan in 1990 as his first WWE match, since WWE was co-promoting it with some other promotions in Japan. I don't count that. So he has that distinction. But, you know, they pulled the plug on Breeze's push almost instantly, within a few months. They pulled the plug on his push after he got called down to the main roster, and he never recovered. I mean, not as a singles. He found some success in a comedy duo with Fandango, but he was never really given a chance. I mean, how many times have we said that about people who were called down to the main roster from NXT? You know, I always likened it to Honky Tonk Man. Got a lot of heel heat as the Intercontinental Champion, right? As a guy who was just completely full of himself and people wanted to see him get his ass handed to him. I think Breeze, in that gimmick that he had at that time with the selfie stick and coming from seasonal residences and singing his own song and all that stuff, he could have been a similar type of heel. I don't want to compare him to Shawn Michaels because he's not Shawn Michaels, but it does make me think of Shawn Michaels when he first went single as a heel in 1992. And he sang his own song and he would look at his reflection in the mirror when Sherry would carry the mirror around to the ring for his entrances. I always envision Breeze finding success right at that IC title level. But when they give up on you, it's very hard to recover from that. And he never did. Killian Dane was cut. Big Damo. Same week that his wife turned into a superhero. He lost his job. He's been part of a comedy team with Drake Maverick. When they first started it, I thought for sure they would end up with the tag team titles. And I really think that not being in front of fans is what killed them. I really do. I think that act with the two of them as the unwilling partners and that corny, cheesy music, you know, whatever limited number of fans they had there in the COVID Coliseum, it's not the same. I think that act would have gotten over at Full Sail in front of, you know, 400 or 500 people every week. His fate may have turned out differently were it not for the pandemic. But in recent weeks, they phased those two down a lot. They really weren't being featured as much on television. He posted a long statement on social media thanking a bunch of people in the company, very appreciative for his time in WWE, but he admitted that he's angry. Said, "While I know this wasn't personal, that chip is back on my shoulder, and you will regret letting me back into the world. I'm only 36, I love what I do, I believe I'm entering my prime, and I cannot wait to show you what you missed. See you in 90 days. And good for him. I hope he does. I hope he finds success somewhere else. Marina Shafir was let go. That was surprising. Not that they've been using her at all lately, but because there were reportedly plans to bring her back to TV, She is married to Roderick Strong, and the last time we saw her on television was with Roddy when they did that one segment on NXT television where he handed his resignation letter into William Regal. That was the last time we saw Roddy until he reappeared on TV this week with this new Diamond Mine faction. That could have been a great re-entry point for her if they wanted a female badass in that group. And then she gets fired. So that leaves Shayna Baszler as the sole horsewoman from Ronda Rousey's squad that's left. I mean, I guess Ronda might still technically be under WWE contract, but right now, Shayna is the last woman standing. And they have her feuding with a doll on TV. Ever Rise, Chase Parker, Matt Martell, who just wrestled Hit Row on this week's NXT. They were on the list of cuts. They've been doing comedy skits backstage for a few weeks. Not a real surprise. Arturo Huas, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy who made a handful of NXT appearances, and then he was brought in for the massive success that was Raw Underground. He got drafted to the Raw brand after that last fall, and then he was quietly moved back to NXT. And he tore his biceps in a match with Kushida back in November and was never heard from again. 6 years. He spent 6 years under contract with WWE. Clearly, they were not going to be doing much with him, although now I see reports and rumors that he was going to originally be included in this Diamond Mine faction, which, honestly, I mean, he probably would have been a good fit for it, but certainly up to this point, it never seemed like they had any clear direction for him. And again, not really a shocking name to end up on the list. Tony Nese, his big moment came on the kickoff show at WrestleMania 35, where he beat Buddy Murphy to win the Cruiserweight title. Nese is a native New Yorker, so I'm sure that was a big moment for him to win the title at MetLife Stadium. He was on the list. Aria Davari, August Gray, who used to wrestle under the name Anthony Green. He came over from Evolve after Evolve closed up. Kurt Stallion, who only signed with them in October. He had surgery in March for a fractured wrist. He had just been cleared to return, just in time to clean out his locker, I guess. The Bollywood boys, Samir and Sunil Singh, who had their greatest success as lackeys for Jinder Mahal when he was getting his big push with the WWE title. They shared a very nice message they received from their hero, good friend of theirs, Bret the Hitman Hart, saying, "You both can hold your heads up and you've always followed your hearts, gave your best every night, and always kept your integrity. The answers to what comes next will soon appear to you, and if I can offer any support or advice, you know I'm here for you both. I'm proud of you both." Well, that was very nice. I think I would shit myself if I got that kind of text message from Bret Hart. But these are all 205 Live guys. All the names I just mentioned, from Nese to Davari to the Singh brothers, these are all 205 Live guys. And I don't know anybody who watches 205 Live. Not with any kind of regularity. So it made these people the most expendable names on the roster. When they're doing budget cuts, these are going to be the first names on the chopping block. And it does not bode well for the future of 205 Live that they basically let go of 80% of the show's roster. Sean Ross Sapp says that gutting 205 Live was not one of the plans that Triple H had to further emphasize the Cruiserweight division, which they recently started doing more of with Kushida as the champion, right? He's had this open challenge now for several weeks. I don't get the sense that Triple H is consulted on any of this stuff before it happens. And he can't be very happy about that. I mean, at this rate, outside of existing international deals they may have to satisfy, I don't see the need for 205 Live at all. I haven't seen the need for 205 Live in a long time. It would make more sense to slowly integrate whatever Cruiserweight names are left into the NXT brand and just make it exclusively an NXT property. I don't see the need for 205 Live. The last name on the list is Tino Sabatelli. who was fired last April, then rehired in October, and then never wrestled a single match. About 10 days ago, he tweeted about the LA Knight segment on NXT. When LA Knight attacked the Million Dollar Man, he said, "This is cute, but how about an actual multimillionaire getting involved?" Because he played 6 years in the NFL before signing with WWE, so I'm sure he is. He probably is a legit millionaire. Which is good, because now that he's unemployed, he can take his time finding a new job. The most egregious of all these releases so far, with all these cuts over the past few months, the most egregious of all these releases has been Samoa Joe and Aleister Black. Joe is already back on NXT. Black, I'm thinking, and by all reports I've been reading, the betting odds are that he will land in AEW. You know, and I hope he does. WWE was supposedly having second thoughts on axing him and thinking they made a mistake. Yeah, no shit. They made a mistake. I hope he doesn't just waltz back in thinking that this time things are going to be, you know, magically different than they were before. Any of these other names, I mean, you know, look, they'd fit in fine on any roster. I hope they find work. But I don't see any of them as a real difference maker. And that doesn't mean that they can't get a fresh start somewhere. They can't reinvent themselves and prove me wrong. I hope they do. I think it's a shame that WWE has spent years stockpiling talent without any real regard for what to do with them, only just to go and discard them when they want to save a few bucks. That, I think, is the real shame in this. Now, there was one more release this week, again, that we know of, and this is the one that got the most attention. WWE recently hired, for those who don't know, they hired at least two female comedy writers. Millie Tamarez is one. She was hired to write for SmackDown. And Kenise Mobley was hired as a writer on the Monday Night Raw brand. Mobley is a stand-up comedian. I had never heard of her before, but apparently she does stand-up comedy. And she was the guest on the Asian Not Asian podcast 2 weeks ago. This was not a podcast that dropped this week. This podcast dropped at least 2 weeks ago, where she talked about being hired by WWE, and she admitted that she knew next to nothing about wrestling. They asked her, "Were you a wrestling fan before this?" "No." You know, and being a wrestling fan as a kid, I mean, that's not a prerequisite for the job, but she knew nothing. She knew nothing about wrestling. Now, I listened to it. I didn't just read the transcript. I listened to it. Yes, she is a comedian, and she was in some spots trying to be funny, but not trying to be funny in a way where it came off like she was just making it up. I think she was being honest, but she was just kind of talking in a comedic way. But I want to give a hat tip to post-wrestling here for the transcription, because I want to read these comments here that got everybody all stirred up. She said, "I've just been hired by WWE. Given the things that you know about me and my entire life and what I'm into, yes, that is surprising. They did not require me to know anything about wrestling, but I do have a background in film production and comedy writing, and they're like, perfect, come on in. So I am on the Monday Night Raw team. There's Monday Night Raw and Friday Night SmackDown, and the people I know that are on it are Bobby..." His name is either Bobby Ashley or Bobby Lashley, and I really should know that. "He's like this giant black guy, and he and the people who are part of his crew, I know that they call, or at least as of last year, they called themselves the Hurt Business. The Hurt Business. They wear suits, and they're like, we're cool." And she went on to say, "I went on a date, and this guy was like, don't you feel like you're..." He effectively said, "Don't you feel like you're diminishing your dignity writing for WWE? And I was like, I'm getting paid to do the thing that I've been working on for 8 years. And this is twice, or no, this is three times what I make at my nonprofit job. So yeah, I'm going to take it." As you might imagine, these comments caused quite a shitstorm online among fans on social media who were appalled that this woman knew nothing about pro wrestling and that she dared get the name wrong of the current WWE champion on the brand that she now writes for. Or did write for. Sean Ross Sapp says that he was told fan reaction to her podcast appearance had little to nothing to do with the decision for WWE to let her go. That it was more of an internal concern. And that might have been what he was told, but I think that's a load of shit. The podcast appearance, as I pointed out, was 2 weeks ago. 24 hours after this suddenly blew up on social media, she was let go. Now, the only other thing I could think of is she was not allowed, perhaps, to make that appearance. They weren't aware of it. The fan reaction made them aware of the fact that she went on this podcast, and maybe they fired her because she wasn't allowed to make an appearance. I would assume, though, if that she was told, you are not allowed to go out and do a podcast appearance, that she wouldn't have done it. So again, I just think it's a load of shit. It's a little too coincidental that right after the fan uproar online, she was fired. Of course it was. Of course it had to do with the fan reaction online. I will bet anything that the fan reaction is what made them aware of the interview in the first place. They probably didn't even know that she was on that podcast. And one of the things that probably did her in, and I don't see too many people talking about this, everybody seems so hung up on her not having any wrestling knowledge. I mean, as if that's her fault. The job didn't require her to have any prior product knowledge. To this company, product knowledge is... I was going to say product knowledge is a plus. It's not a requirement. I'm not so sure that product knowledge is a plus. Because you have stories of other people, even years ago, who would audition for jobs and stuff. And if they picked up on the fact that you were a wrestling fan, it actually worked against you. That's how sick the mindset is among some of the people in this company. But, again, if you ever look at a WWE job posting... I'm not looking at job postings in WWE like I'm interested in applying for one because I don't have a fucking death wish. But they're constantly, this constant turnover on the writing side. And you'll see, like on Twitter, there'll be a job posting that comes up. If you ever really read the job postings, in the majority of cases, if you really kind of read them over, product knowledge is not a requirement. It is not mandatory. It's a plus. Or at least it was. Maybe they'll change that policy now. But I think what really pissed them off and really did her in was the comment that she shared from her friend about being worried, or when she was on a date or whatever it was that she said, about being worried. Are you worried that by working for WWE, you're somehow diminishing your dignity? And she didn't say no. If she would have said no, not at all, and then she, you know... That might have been different, but she didn't disagree. She didn't defend the company at all. She just said, well, it pays more money, so I took the job. The reality is, that was a very stupid thing for her to share publicly. And she knew that it was risky even talking about any of this because she jokingly made a comment at the beginning that she hopes that WWE doesn't hear this interview and then revoke her offer. And they kind of laughed it off because, you know, it's a comedy podcast. Ha ha ha. But she acknowledged that she knew she could get in trouble for this. So she was a little too honest for her own good, and it cost her her job. But here's the deal. She said that she was hired to write dialogue for the wrestlers in between their matches. I assume that means, you know, backstage segments. Before they went out to the ring and such. I talk all the time on this show about how awful most of the scripted dialogue is on these shows. These people don't even sound human. They sound completely robotic and unnatural and inauthentic. Some people are better at delivering scripted lines than others, right? Some people can take words that other people write for them and they can do okay. A lot of people can't. It's very hard to do that. It's very hard to write for someone else. Like, you're using someone else's words. I know actors do it in movies all the time. That's a little bit different. We're not going that deep here. I mean, they say in pro wrestling, the best character is like, you're basically being your real self with the volume turned up, right? You're not Heath Ledger playing the fucking Joker. So it's not exactly apples to apples here. It's a hard thing to do. A lot of people can't do it. And I think hiring people who know absolutely nothing, not just about wrestling, but about the product itself or the wrestlers themselves. Look, you know, you can give someone a crash course, but unless you really know these characters inside out and you follow the product closely enough to know about their history and their character traits, it just doesn't work. You're writing stuff for characters that you admittedly know nothing about. She couldn't even get the name of the champion straight. All she knew about him was that he's a big black guy who wears a suit and runs with a group that doesn't even exist anymore. You're doing a disservice to the talent by hiring people who are not qualified for the position. She may have technically met the qualifications that were listed in the job posting, but they're not really qualified for the position. But, as bad as that dialogue is, I have absolutely no problem with them hiring experienced writers for the job who can do a better job than they're doing now. And I also think that having an old white guy like Vince McMahon trying to relate to a roster full of millennials, that doesn't work either. Or having writers who can't relate to certain, let's say, ethnic groups, writing for those same ethnic groups. I think diversity on the writing team, be it based on gender or ethnicity, can be a good thing. I think that's a good thing, because you have a diverse roster, right? Maybe then we wouldn't end up with the Lucha House Party coming out with a fucking piñata. I don't think all of their new hires need to be able to recite the names of every Royal Rumble winner in history, but they should be required to have a decent amount of product knowledge. The problem is, not as many people watch the product today as they used to, so you're pulling from a relatively small pool of candidates. But even still, at least be familiar with the brand that you're writing for. I don't blame her for that. I don't blame Kenise Mobley for that. But saying some of the things that she said on that podcast, she knew that she might get fired for it. She said it anyway, and that's exactly what happened. I'm all for getting fresh faces in there who can write good television and write better dialogue. I know those people are out there. I know they are. They have to be. Those people are out there. They exist. You just got to find them. You know, Meltzer in The Observer this week, and this was before they fired her. The Observer dropped on the same day, hours before the firings. But he posted in The Observer, he said that she had a lot of heat on her internally for talking publicly about things that WWE does not like being talked about. And that the company was, according to one person, embarrassed. And that they felt it made them look blindingly stupid. That was the quote that he had in The Observer. They felt they looked blindingly stupid to the outside world. A lot of the stuff they do makes them look blindingly stupid to the inside wrestling world, let alone the outside world. But apparently that's how they felt. Well, I got news for you. If you hire someone to work for you, and that person then openly talks about your hiring practices in public, and you think that makes you look blindingly stupid, maybe the problem isn't the person that you just hired. Maybe the problem lies in your fucking hiring practices. That's the main reason that she was fired. She was fired because the company was embarrassed. She embarrassed them. And they have nobody to blame but themselves for being embarrassed. They don't want to hire wrestling people. You ask yourself, why would they bring in people who aren't required to have wrestling knowledge or product knowledge? They don't want to hire wrestling people because they don't see themselves as a wrestling company. They're ashamed of it. You could feel the disdain. You can hear the disdain in Vince McMahon's voice on that Stone Cold podcast years ago that he did whenever Austin would call it pro wrestling. He hates it. He loathes being called pro wrestling. But that's what it is. And that's what it'll always be. Nobody is ever, never ever going to say, hey, let's go to the sports entertainment matches tonight. Nobody is ever going to say that. It is fucking wrestling. So I am not surprised that it is not a requirement for the job. I think both parties were in the wrong here. Some of the comments she made were just asking for trouble. Some of the comments she made were blindingly stupid. She may be a comedian, but companies don't often have a sense of humor about these things. You and I may have a sense of humor. She may have a sense of humor. Big corporations, they don't have a sense of humor. Nick Khan does not have a sense of humor. Or he has a very grim sense of humor. There may be examples of people who they hire, who they bring in, who don't have hardly any product knowledge, and maybe it does work out. Look at Jimmy Smith. On Raw, he's been doing a pretty good job so far. Much better than Adnan Virk as the lead play-by-play guy on Monday Night Raw. And if you remember, when his name was first announced as the new play-by-play commentator, there was an old tweet from a few years ago that was dug up where he admitted that he hadn't watched wrestling since he was a kid. He wasn't familiar with it. He's an MMA guy. But so far, it's working out. He's putting the work in, right? He hasn't embarrassed himself on television. I'm not saying that it can't work. You can't ever bring anybody from the outside who has little to no product knowledge and they're never going to succeed. I would like, you know, for at least a basic amount of product knowledge to be, you know, required of, people who are going to work in this company. But I do think that there is a need for more people who can write better dialogue, whether or not, you know, they have super wrestling knowledge or not. It's a big problem on a lot of these shows. We need people who can write better dialogue, who are experienced writers, because the dialogue on a lot of these shows sucks. I'm sure Bobby Ashley would agree. Monday Night Raw. Having Money in the Bank qualifiers on this show helped it flow better than usual because there was something on the line. The theme of the night was upsets in most of those matches. You had three former WWE champions losing to put the newer faces. I mean, to the extent that you can say John Morrison is a newer face, which he really isn't, but putting them into the men's Money in the Bank match. And I liked what they did at the end of the show with Bobby Lashley and Xavier Woods and him destroying Woods after the match and making Kofi watch. I thought that was a strong angle. Kofi Kingston challenged Bobby Lashley to a WWE Championship match at the beginning of the show. Lashley accepted, so they're going to have a match at Money in the Bank. But to make sure that it stays one-on-one, Lashley challenged Xavier Woods to a match. And Woods cut this passionate promo and said that the match would take place inside Hell in a Cell, which happened to still be hanging above the ring. I guess they forgot to take it down from the night before. But what is going on here is USA Network was said to be very upset that Fox got a Hell in a Cell match the week before with Roman Reigns and Rey Mysterio. So I guess this was their way of placating them by giving them their own cell match. That's how upset they were. The WWE felt they had to go out of their way to give them their own Hell in a Cell match. This is like two siblings. One gets a present and the other one gets jealous. And so mommy has to go buy the other little brat the same gift to get them to stop whining about it. That's what's going on here between basically Peacock, NBC Universal, and Fox. So we end up with two Hell in a Cell matches on free television, pretty much unannounced, within the matter of a few days. I mean, it's already a dead gimmick, you may as well. I can't even get upset about it. There were people online who were really upset about this. How can you get upset about this at this point? How many years has it been that we have had Hell in a Cell as its own standalone pay-per-view? When did they start doing it? I want to say 2009. Over a decade of this, and every single year, steadily more and more and more, the match just gets less and less and less and less special. Now they painted it red, it looks fucking atrocious. Who cares? Hell in a Cell is a dead gimmick. It is a dead gimmick. There is no reviving it. As long as there is a pay-per-view dedicated to nothing but Hell in a Cell matches, it is a dead gimmick. It was nice while it lasted, but it is a dead gimmick. So they can spit one out on television every week. Who cares? Who cares? Ricochet beat AJ Styles to qualify for the men's Money in the Bank match. Of course, he needed a distraction to do it. The Viking Raiders ran out to attack Omos. But Ricochet earns himself a rare pay-per-view appearance. He doesn't get too many of those. John Morrison qualified for Money in the Bank with a win over Randy Orton. And I will say that I was mildly amused by Miz spraying Orton in the face with the drip stick and then trying to wheel himself away in his wheelchair while Riddle came down and chased after him on his scooter. I mean, as I say that out loud, it sounds completely embarrassing. But on this show, I will take what little amusement I can find. All of this distracted Orton, though, which led to Starship Pain and a win for Morrison. Morrison is going to shine in a ladder match. We know that. So he is a much better fit than Randy Orton is for that type of match anyway. Sonya Deville and Adam Pearce met with Rhea Ripley in the ring about getting herself intentionally disqualified at Hell in a Cell against Charlotte. And because of this, and you knew exactly where this was going, Charlotte Flair is getting yet another match for the Raw Women's title. And you knew it, right? I mean, you knew before the show even went on the air. You knew that this was going to be the outcome. There's three things in life that are guaranteed. Death, taxes, and Charlotte Flair wrestling for the championship. So they will have their match of Money in the Bank. Asuka and Naomi qualified for Money in the Bank on the women's side with a win over Eva Marie and the newly rechristened, or I should say christened, because technically she never had a name on the show, Doudrop. Piper Niven is officially now Doudrop. She was named by Eva in a backstage segment. Eva was looking her up and down, and she said, "You look like Doudrop." And Piper did not seem pleased with her new name. So they had a tag team match, and Niven had things well in hand with Naomi when Eva tagged herself in, and that proved to be a mistake when she got pinned. So there's already trouble brewing between Eva Marie and Doudrop 2 weeks in. That's not a good sign. Although maybe it is, because maybe they're going to split. maybe this pairing will not last that long. But this all brings me to Nikki Cross, who is now a superhero. She was dressed up in a superhero outfit with a blue eye mask, and she had blue eye makeup underneath. She's got a cape. She is the new Mighty Molly. And she teamed with Alexa Bliss, her former best friend, who has since been demonically possessed. But there they were, teaming like it was nothing. And they beat Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler to qualify for Money in the Bank. The demon and the superhero are in the Money in the Bank match after Bliss once again hypnotized Reginald and Shayna Baszler was rolled up and pinned. Again, with the hypnotic shit. This sucked. And as for the superhero here, Nikki Cross, you know, with Doudrop already having issues with Eva Marie, here's the question I pose to you. How long before she ends up in a tag team with Nikki Cross? Actually, you know, Piper Niven and Nikki Cross as a team would make for a nice addition to that women's tag team division. Two fellow Scots. But not as Doudrop and Wonder Woman. This is not a Vince McMahon creation, by the way. This was a Nikki Cross idea that she pitched. She's been working on this for months. She pitched the idea and they actually ran with it. Which just goes to show that the wrestlers can pitch plenty of their own bad ideas. It's not just limited to Vince McMahon. But I actually think this will get over in front of live fans. I think people like Nikki Cross. I think they like her. She has a likable quality about her. They want to see her succeed. They're not going to boo her. So it will probably work. Whatever work means. I don't know if it's going to lead her to a championship or not, but I think that this will work for her. The issue is that before she vanished from television, and she disappeared, I don't believe she was hurt or anything, but there was a period of a few months where Nikki Cross just disappeared from Monday Night Raw. Before she vanished from television, there was really nothing wrong with her. So I just find it very sad that they even need to pitch ideas like this just to get noticed, because that's what she did here. She came up with an idea because they weren't doing anything with her. She wasn't on television anymore. Once they split her away from Alexa Bliss. And so she came up with this crazy, zany, wacky idea that they ran with. And now, is it going to work or not? We'll see. I think it can. Doesn't mean I like it. I'm just saying I don't think it'll be booed out of the building. But the fact that she even had to come up with something like this is very sad. because there was absolutely nothing wrong with crazy Nikki Cross before they yanked her off TV. We had Matt Riddle beating Drew McIntyre. They had about a 20-minute match qualifier for Money in the Bank. A very good match. Best match on the entire show. Yet another upset, right? Ricochet was billed as an upset. John Morrison over Orton was billed as an upset. This was the biggest of them all. Riddle pinned the former WWE champion with a victory roll. Clean in the middle of the ring. And Randy Orton walked out on stage, arms crossed, sour puss on his face. He did not qualify. He was not very happy. And Riddle went over and was asking him, "What's wrong, Randy? What's wrong?" And Orton wouldn't respond. Of course, they are doing this last chance shit again for Money in the Bank, where all the losers get one more chance to qualify. It's going to be with AJ Styles, Drew McIntyre, and Randy Orton. This is going to be where Drew McIntyre works his way into the Money in the Bank match, because it's the only way. I mean, unless he can cash in on some other championship, and they seem to change the rules every year, so who the fuck knows what's allowed and what's not. But it's the only way that he could possibly get another shot at the WWE title. Because as it stands, with that loss at Hell in a Cell last weekend, he's no longer allowed to challenge Bobby Lashley for the title. Money in the Bank could be a workaround to that. And speaking of Lashley, we had Lashley against Xavier Woods, non-title, in the main event. The first Hell in a Cell match on Monday Night Raw in almost 25 years. Kofi Kingston watched from the outside. Woods got more offense in here than I thought he would. This was definitely more competitive than I expected. He did his diving elbow off the ropes through a table with Lashley on top of it. But Lashley kicked out. Lashley speared him. He tapped him out with the Hurt Lock. MVP slipped into the cage after they opened the door when the match was over. And then he immediately shut the door behind him and padlocked it shut, so that Kofi could not get inside while Lashley reapplied the Hurt Lock. And he made Kofi watch. Kofi Kingston is banging on the cell, telling him to let go, let go. And Lashley has got Woods. He's got him pressed up face first against the cage, making him suffer, making Kofi watch, and there is nothing that he can do about it. I like that. No comedy, no funny business. Pure heel shit. Make the babyface watch his best friend suffer. He made the New Day suffer. Now, Kofi Kingston, he is not winning the WWE Championship. Not now, and if not ever, certainly not for a long time. And try as they might, you're not going to get me to buy into the fact that he will. But you can at least try to build him up, now that he is number one contender, you can try to build him up as more of a serious challenger, which is what they're seemingly trying to do. You know, I said the last couple of weeks, the backstage banter between MVP and Kofi Kingston has been some of the most compelling stuff on the entire show. This angle here was pretty compelling stuff, and now this Monday night, tomorrow night on Raw, Kofi and MVP are going to go face to face, and I would not be surprised if that ends up being the best thing on the entire show. They've got to go out there and sell you on the idea that Kofi Kingston has a shot to reclaim the WWE Championship. But it's not going to happen. Also tomorrow night, like I said, last chance Money in the Bank qualifier with all the losers, AJ, Orton, McIntyre. They're doing Rhea Ripley, Mandy Rose, and Dana Brooke against Charlotte Flair, Natalya, and Tamina. And in a strap match, Jackson Ryker, one-on-one with Elias. That might be around the time that my finger slips and I accidentally hit the remote control. End up watching David on QVC. And David on QVC every night. Big fan. Big fan of David. Paul Heyman said it best in the closing segment on SmackDown Friday night. There's no one left. In less than a year, Roman Reigns has wiped out the men's division on SmackDown. He said The Fiend got frightened, Braun Strowman got slaughtered, Kevin Owens got KO'd, Edge and Daniel Bryan got stacked up and neutered at WrestleMania. Bryan came back, but he got shipped right back out. Cesaro got clobbered, and the Mysterios were sent down to hell. So who's left? Earlier in the show, Seth Rollins and Bayley picked up a win over Cesaro and Bianca Belair, with Bayley pinning Bianca. I told you. What did I say? What did I say? We would be getting a third match between these two women, even though Bianca won the first two matches. I mean, she won inside the cell. That usually is pretty definitive. But I said, of course there's going to be a third match. Because they don't have anybody else. And they have to kill time before Sasha Banks comes back for SummerSlam. Later in the show, they announced that Sonya Deville was going to announce the first SmackDown entrant into the Women's Money in the Bank ladder match. She was going to hand-pick this person. But yet, the men and the women on Raw and the men on SmackDown all have to qualify to get into the Money in the Bank matches. But the women of SmackDown do not. They get hand-picked. Now, why do you think that is? Why do you think that? I'll tell you why. Because this is the entire women's division right now on SmackDown. I'm going to read it off to you right now. Bianca Belair, who is the champion, right? So she's not going to be in Money in the Bank, so you can put her on the side. Sasha Banks, Bayley, Carmella, Liv Morgan, and then Natty and Tamina, who are the women's tag team champions right now, so they won't be in Money in the Bank either. So really, that leaves four women. Four. Who could reasonably qualify for Money in the Bank. That is pathetic. That right there illustrates just how rail thin that women's roster is on SmackDown right now. And why they desperately need NXT to be part of this draft after SummerSlam. Just goes to what I've been saying. Sonya Deville named Carmella to a spot in the Ladies Money in the Bank match. Liv Morgan interrupted, which led to a match between the two of them. That Morgan won, her second win now over Carmella. But there was no announcement or indication of whether or not this meant that she earned her way into the Money in the Bank match. They'll both end up in the match. When all is said and done, Carmella will be in, Liv Morgan will be in. But this is part of a bad pattern right now on this show. SmackDown is just rematch after rematch after rematch, week in, week out. This week it was Carmella and Liv. It was Big E and Apollo Crews in a Money in the Bank qualifier, which Big E won, and I hate pinning the Intercontinental Champion in a non-title match like that, unless Big E is going to be challenging him next for the title, which doesn't look like he is. They announced that next week we're going to get a last man standing Money in the Bank qualifier between Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. So much for Owens tweeting the other day that he was going away for a while after his loss at Hell in a Cell. A while, apparently, was 1 week. But it's just rematch after rematch after rematch. These roster shakeups are badly needed right now. And we're still in June. We're not even talking about the draft until the end of August. I don't know if they can go that long. Jimmy Uso. He's all in with Roman Reigns. Jimmy has taken Jay's place as the ass-kissing Uso. Roman told him to go ahead and prove it. Prove his loyalty. And Paul Heyman told him, go win a match. And that match was against Dolph Ziggler. The match was fine. I mean, it's Dolph. I just cannot bring myself to give a shit. Actually, I think it took Jimmy far too long to beat Dolph Ziggler. If I were Roman Reigns, I wouldn't be very happy about that. But Reigns and Heyman came to the ring at the end of the show. They left Jimmy in the back for his State of the Universal title address. And I mentioned before what Heyman said about how there's nobody left. Earlier in the show, after his win, Seth Rollins told Adam Pearce and Sonya Deville that he wants the next shot at Roman Reigns. And they told him that they would take it under advisement. So now fast forward here to the end of the show, before Roman could even say a word, before he can even lift the microphone to his lips, he was interrupted by Edge, back for the first time since WrestleMania. He's got a big bushy beard now, like a Viking. He made a beeline for Roman. The two of them brawled. Jimmy eventually came out to help, but he got tossed aside. And in the funniest moment on the show, they showed Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman. They had retreated up the aisle onto the stage, right? So they're standing there. They're standing on stage. And Edge gets back into the ring. He looks dead into the hard camera. And he starts screaming, Roman, where are you at? Where are you at? I'm right here. Where are you? Turn to the right, dude. He's right there. He's literally standing right there. He sounded ridiculous. Just turn your fucking head to the right. The man is standing right there. You can address him face to face. I don't know what that was all about. That made him look like a fool. But now it looks clear where they're going with this, what the direction is. Seth Rollins wants the next shot. He ain't gonna get it. Edge is going to get it instead. And we never got a singles match between Edge and Roman. Daniel Bryan had wormed his way into the match at WrestleMania, even though Edge had won the Royal Rumble. He really should have gotten his match one-on-one. He really did get jobbed out, if you think about it. And Bryan stole his thunder. So now Edge gets his one-on-one match. But Seth Rollins is going to cost Edge the victory and Money in the Bank, which then leads to the match that I pitched weeks ago for SummerSlam, which is Edge against Seth Rollins. Wasn't going to be Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns. It wasn't going to be Seth Rollins and Big E or any of these other people. It was going to be Edge and Seth Rollins. That seemed like the obvious direction to go in, and now it looks pretty clear that that is what we are going to get. That is how we get to that as the destination. And that then frees up Roman Reigns to defend against John Cena, who will be back on television very soon. Roman and Edge, it is kind of a rematch too, I mean, to the point that I was making earlier, but it'll be their first singles match, so I think it's fine. It's a good match, it's a good marquee match to headline Money in the Bank with, but they need to stop with all of the rematches on this show, and they need to get some new blood onto the roster, because it isn't just the women's division that needs fresh faces. The tag team division is absurdly thin, and the way to solve that problem is to merge the tag team divisions into one. You have one set of titles, just like they do with the women's tag belts. But so long as the brand split exists, they're not going to do it. So, let's take a look at this Money in the Bank lineup so far. On the men's Money in the Bank side, as of today, qualified, we have Ricochet, John Morrison, Matt Riddle, and Big E, with AJ Styles, Randy Orton, and Drew McIntyre fighting over a spot tomorrow night, and Owens and Zayn fighting for a spot this Friday. I think McIntyre gets the spot, which makes McIntyre or Big E, I think, the favorites right now to win the briefcase. On the women's side, we have Asuka, Nikki Cross, Alexa Bliss, Naomi, and Carmella, all having qualified. I mean, Carmella didn't really qualify, but she is in the match. Liv Morgan will probably be added, so what does that leave? How many we got here? One, two, three. Two spots? I don't know how many. Do we even know how many women they're going to have? I assume eight. Who knows? I think there's two spots left open. If they bring back Sasha Banks early and she qualifies, then she's a shoo-in to win. But Sasha in a ladder match, that scares me. I don't know that I would risk that before SummerSlam. Honestly, you know, just looking at those names so far, I think on the women's side, I think Alexa Bliss has got to be the early favorite. I mean, she could just stare at the ladder when everybody is on it and make it tip over. She's got magical powers, right? She's got a psychotic doll. So she would be my early pick to win. But we still don't have all the names locked in yet. Fightful Select reported this week that NXT held a talent show to try to give the roster a morale boost, especially with all the recent releases. I would imagine morale isn't exactly sky high right now. Attendance was said to be mandatory, and they had everything from singing to stand-up comedy, hopefully not with their writers. Hey, maybe they had magic tricks, too. Nick Khan, he did some magic tricks this week. He made about 20% of the roster disappear. Nothing says morale boost like mandatory attendance. I love it. The ratings may not have reflected it, but I thought NXT had a strong show this week, with very good matches to open and close the show, and the arrival of the new Diamond Mine faction, led by Malcolm Bivens. It's about time they gave him more to do on this show. He's been under contract for so long, and they've done very little with him. But I think, as a manager, he can be a real asset on this brand, and now we might actually have a chance to see him thrive in that role. They've also been airing these graphics the past couple of weeks of the little battery indicator on someone's phone, showing that it's charging. Last week it started at 1%, then it went up to 10% and 11%, up to 20% and 21%, and this week it was up to 51%. Halfway there. Given the constant charging, we know it's an iPhone, clearly. Maybe it'll be fully charged in time for the Great American Bash on July 6th. Maybe the whole recharging thing could represent someone returning. That's what I was thinking in my mind. Instead of a new debut, it could represent somebody getting a second start, right? Someone whose battery was drained, maybe on the main roster, and they make their way back to NXT, recharge the batteries, getting a fresh start. Either that or the fucking Energizer Bunny is about to make his NXT debut. I can't wait for them to give him a new name, since we've already had one bunny on WWE television this year. I will reiterate what I said in my TakeOver review last week. Adam Cole's new music sucks, and they need to change it back. Just makes him sound like generic creator wrestler number 13 when he walks to the ring. It's no good. Doesn't fit his character. Last week, William Regal told both Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly that before their match at the Great American Bash, they would each be able to pick an opponent to wrestle on this week's show. O'Reilly picked Kushida. Cole said he wasn't going to pick his opponent because he was told to do so, right? He's like a child in high school. You tell me to do something, I'm not going to do it. Your parent tells you to go clean your room, you say, I'm not going to do it. That's what Adam Cole was acting like here. So, Carmelo Hayes comes walking to the ring. He answers the challenge, and I thought he looked impressive in his second NXT appearance. I thought his sell, by the way, on the finish, Cole hit a Panama Sunrise and picked up the win. I thought Hayes' sell of the Panama Sunrise was fantastic. My man here did a handstand before falling down. Io Shirai and Zoe Stark picked up a win over the Robert Stone brand team of Aaliyah and Jesse Kamea. A tune-up for Shirai and Stark, who will be part of a triple threat number one contenders match this Tuesday against Ember Moon and Shotzi Blackheart, and Raquel Gonzalez and Dakota Kai to see who challenges Candice and Indy for their women's tag team titles. If they're ready to move, you know, things ahead on a split between Raquel and Dakota, you can have them win and then challenge for the belt at the Bash and lose. If they're not ready for that, if they're not ready to move that story in that direction, which I'm sure at some point that's exactly where it's going to go, then it'll be Io and Zoe, which makes me think that maybe Frankie Monet somehow costs Io the tag team titles and we get a Frankie against Io match out of it. Johnny Gargano and Austin Theory got a win over Pete Dunne and Oney Lorcan, with Lorcan taking the fall. After the match, Gargano got blindsided by Karrion Kross, who Gargano had spoken less than favorably of earlier in the show. Then in the back, Samoa Joe confronted Kross in the hallway, who reminded Joe that he cannot touch anybody unless provoked. Then Joe let he and Scarlett pass through. Now, I saw that Kross and Bronson Reed, the two top champions on NXT, both had matches on Main Event this past week. Kross took on Shelton Benjamin. They have a draft coming up, and Vince McMahon barely even knows what NXT is. He needs to be reminded every morning when he takes his Hulk Hogan multivitamin what the fuck NXT even means. You think he knows? You think he pays attention to anything that happens on this brand? Have you been paying attention? Of course not. Of course he doesn't know anything about it. He has more important things to do with his time. Like rip up and rewrite the Raw script every week. You think he knows what's going on week to week on NXT? You think he knows who these people are? You think he knows who Austin Theory is? You think he knows who Jake Atlas is? Please. So these guys basically have to have what is comparable to a tryout match. Even though they are the champions on NXT, which airs on USA Network every week, the same network that airs Monday Night Raw. It's like they're having an audition. They stripped his entrance of all the things that make it cool. The lights, the smoke show, right? That being Scarlet. There was no Scarlet Bordeaux. The rumor was that they were considering her for her own run in the women's division and separating her away from Karrion Kross, and that was pretty much proven out because this week at SmackDown, they had Scarlett and Shotzi Blackheart have matches. Kind of gave Scarlett her own edition on her own. Now, it's only main event. Hardly anybody watches main event. So this was effectively a dark match. But if they call this man up and they give him the entrance they gave him on main event last week, and I think they brought him back for another tryout match this week, then he's dead in the water. Because part of what makes him different, part of what works with the Karrion Kross character, and I know not everybody is sold on Karrion Kross. I happen to like the guy. I happen to think he has a certain stage presence about him. He speaks really well. I think that, you know, he could definitely be a star on the main roster. I don't know, I'm not sold on that attire, that gladiator attire that he wears. I thought he looked more menacing, frankly, when he was on Impact. He was walking out there wearing a suit, looking like a hitman. But if you start to strip away all the things that make him stand out, which a lot of it, frankly, is his entrance, and a big part of it is having Scarlett, having the beautiful blonde in his corner. And yeah, right now it's just, you know, a match on main event, but if they call him up and it's just Karrion Kross and that's it, it's going to be a lot harder for him to get over. You're taking away, you're stripping away all of the elements that make him stand out on NXT. And they have done this time and time again with other people who they have called up from NXT, and I don't want to see the same thing happen to this guy. Changing things for the sake of changing them. We've seen this time and time again. So for his sake, I hope it was just a one-time thing. We got more Hit Row on this show. More Hit Row is never a bad thing. We had Mr. $2,500 himself, AJ Francis, or Top Dollar. It's too bad he doesn't pay Top Dollar on that WWE Most Wanted Treasure show. On NXT, he's Top Dollar. He and Ashanti the Adonis picked up a quick squash win over Ever-Rise in what ended up being the final match for Ever-Rise in NXT. They had them do the JOB on the way out, and they didn't even realize that they were on the way out. They did this last time, too, when they had a whole big batch of releases. Did that with Drake Wirtz. Mr. Q over there, the referee. They had him work one last NXT show before kicking him to the curb. But I'm a big fan of Hit Row. We need to see more of them on the show in the weeks to come. Mercedes Martinez, she learned about a mixed tag team match that was made for this Tuesday with her and a partner of her, not of her choosing, just a partner, would be taking on Xia Li and Boa, who attacked her in the middle of this promo, and then Jake Atlas showed up randomly and ran them off. So there's the partner. And Kyle O'Reilly, in the main event, got a win over the Cruiserweight champion Kushida with a cradle, non-title match, very good match. They shook hands after it was over until O'Reilly spotted Adam Cole getting into the ring, and then he pushed Kushida to the side to go after Cole. As they brawled out of the building, Samoa Joe and the security staff gave chase. Back in the ring, though, Kushida was attacked by the returning Roderick Strong, who did not come alone. He had Tyler Rust with him, and Hideki Suzuki, who most people probably didn't even know. I didn't know who it was. And with them was Malcolm Bivens. You know, Bivens calls Tyler Rust his Diamond in the Rust, which is kind of a corny name, but that was the nickname he gave Tyler Rust. I guess this is a playoff of that name now. He has himself an entire diamond mine. And we have a new faction, heel faction, just like that, in NXT. There's a lot of that going around. AEW says hello.
think they've got a ways to go before they catch up to all the factions in AEW. But even in NXT, we have, let's see, we have Imperium, we have Hit Row, we have The Way. We had Lorcan, Birch, Pete Dunne, and Pat McAfee until McAfee went away, and then Birch got hurt. We have the Robert Stone brand, barely, which isn't really much of a faction. And now we have the Diamond Mine. Bivens held up the Cruiserweight title to show strong, and that looks to be the next program, and very likely your next Cruiserweight champion, probably, is Roderick Strong. Interestingly, his wife, Marina Shafir, one of the four horsewomen of MMA, was released. She was among the releases this week, as I mentioned earlier. And that sounds like it came as a surprise. I don't know if they were... I mean, there are reports they were planning on bringing her back soon, coming up with a new name for her, a new idea for her. I don't know if she would have been linked to the Diamond Mine. Maybe she would have been, you know, with Roderick Strong. I mean, look, the last time we saw Roddy on TV, he was handing in his resignation to William Regal a few months ago, and he had Marina Shafir with him because they're married in real life. So once she appeared on camera with him, you know, there it is. In storyline, you could easily link the two of them up. I don't know if there were plans to do that or not. But if there were, those plans obviously now are out the window, and it makes you wonder, what does he think? What does Roderick Strong think about that? He's not the only person whose significant other was cut this week. So I'm sure that's not exactly a good feeling for them. But Suzuki, let me talk about Hideki Suzuki here. Didn't he play for the Yankees years ago? I'm thinking of Hideki Matsui. That's what I'm thinking of. But Suzuki, he's an interesting addition. He was brought in full-time earlier this year as a coach at the Performance Center. He's been a well-known face in Japan for over a decade. He's wrestled for pretty, you know, when I look at all the promotions that he's wrestled for pretty much every promotion there except, I think, New Japan. He's 41 years old, which shocked me when I saw that. Surprises me that they would put him on TV. Not necessarily that they would bring him in as a coach, but that they would put him on TV. But then again, you know, Mei Ling or whatever her name is with Xia Li and Boa, she's supposed to be 1,000 years old. So 41 is practically a newborn by comparison. But he's a big dude, 6'3", close to 250 pounds. You know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, 6'3", 250, I mean, that was the norm. He wouldn't stand out at all. Now he sticks out like a sore thumb because how many people in NXT especially do you find that are 6'3", 250 pounds, right? Maybe Karrion Kross. I mean, not too many people. You got some big boys, Karrion Kross, Bronson Reed, you know, Top Dollar. After that, the well runs kind of dry. So NXT has some things cooking right now with the Diamond Mine stuff, the battery graphics obviously are leading to something. Samoa Joe is Regal's muscle. This was week two. And don't forget, there is a draft in a couple of months that could ravage the NXT rosters. A lot of people getting a second look, or in the case of Vince McMahon, I guess, a first look in some of these dark matches and main event matches. They're going to be calling people up from NXT. And I said weeks ago, they have to. They have no choice. They need fresh faces on Raw and SmackDown. In the past, they have not always included NXT talent in the draft. This year, they do not have a choice. So there are going to be some people moving. How many? I don't know. How many women? How many men? How many tag teams? Are there going to be teams and factions broken up? We don't know. Ultimately, there's one person who makes the final decision. And I don't even think he knows. The draft is still 2 months away. A lot can change between now and then. Depending on how many people they call up, it could change the face of the NXT roster. NXT has done well in the past, though, when they have people that get called up, of rebuilding. That is something they have done well before. Remember, there was a period of time where the women's division was practically non-existent. They had a really strong women's division, and they plucked out all of the key players, and they were left with almost nothing. And what they did was, over time, they rebuilt that women's division into arguably the best women's division at least in this country, in any promotion that I could think of, is very strong in NXT. They've proven to be fairly resilient in that way. So if they end up losing a lot of people in the draft, with all the people they've stockpiled, with all the people they have under contract who haven't even debuted on TV yet, and because of the pandemic, they haven't even been able to wrestle locally. They've just been sitting there collecting dust. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are ready, willing, and able to step in and show their face and make a name for themselves on that NXT brand. But right now, when I look at these different stories and programs they're setting up, I mean, there still is a certain spark and a certain excitement that's missing to the weekly NXT show, but I think the pieces are in place for them to have a pretty good summer.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, you know, coming into this week, I knew of about three key events, really important events this week in history. Until I sat down to put all my notes together, I didn't realize how many things actually happened this week in history, and I try not to cover every little thing every week. But this week, it was unavoidable. I looked at the list and I said, man, I can't cut any of this stuff. There are just far too many things that are worth mentioning. And we're going to start all the way back 40 years ago on June 21st, 1981. Dusty Rhodes captured his second NWA World Heavyweight title, defeating Harley Race in 17 minutes at the Omni in Atlanta. This was the longest of Dusty's three title reigns at just 88 days, barely 3 months, before dropping the belt to Ric Flair, which would begin Flair's very first run with the championship. 35 years ago this week, on June 24th, 1986, came the Great Betrayal, as it is known in wrestling circles, after a win over King Kong Bundy and Big John Studd at the WWE Championship Wrestling taping in Poughkeepsie, New York. Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, or as Hogan called him, Orndorff, turned on Hulk Hogan and attacked his partner. Maybe he turned on him because he couldn't say his fucking name right. Orndorff gave him a pile driver and aligned himself with the Heenan family, which began the most lucrative run of his career working on top against Hogan, including the main event of the big event in Toronto in August that sold out with more than 60,000 fans. And then later on, a cage match for the championship on Saturday night's main event. There were rumors that Orndorff was the backup if Andre the Giant couldn't go at WrestleMania 3. They could have extended that feud out a little bit longer and paid things off with Hogan and Mr. Wonderful there at the Silver Dome, but that was not to be. I think the arm injury that Orndorff suffered came during that period where he was feuding with Hogan. I think it was an accident while he was working out at the gym, and because of the spot that he was in, he put off having it treated or letting it heal because he was probably making so much frickin' money on top working with Hogan that he just felt like he couldn't take time off. Unfortunately for him, it turned out to not be a smart move on his part because the injury got progressively worse and the muscles on his, I think it was his right side of the body, began to atrophy. And come to think of it, it might have been a neck injury that led to the arm issue, but I know it affected his arm, and he was really never the same after that. 26 years ago this week, on June 25th, 1995, oh boy, one of the worst WWE pay-per-views of all time took place in Philadelphia. The 1995 King of the Ring, which up to that point garnered the lowest buy rate in company history, with only 150,000 homes paying to see this atrocity. The less said about this show, the better, so I'll make this brief. We had the best wrestler in the entire tournament, Shawn Michaels, get eliminated in the first round of the night after a time limit draw against Kama, and the worst wrestler in the tournament, Mabel, went on to win the entire thing. So that pretty much sums it up for you right there. Bret Hart beat Jerry Lawler in a Kiss My Foot match, the worst of all of the matches I've seen these two guys have, which saw Bret shove his bare foot into Lawler's mouth after it was over. And then he took Lawler's dirty foot, which he claimed on television he hadn't washed in weeks, and he shoved it into Lawler's own mouth. And then later in the show, they showed Lawler throwing up. He was brushing his teeth in the back and rinsing, and he was throwing up in the men's room. No doubt mirroring the reaction of the fans at home by the end of this pay-per-view. And in the main event, Diesel and Bam Bam Bigelow defeated Tatanka and Psycho Sid, representing the Million Dollar Corporation. The two guards opening and closing the doors of the entranceway were a young Matt and Jeff Hardy, who would routinely do jobs on television at that time. Jeff was only 17 years old. That should be considered child abuse after watching this shit show. They went off the air 11 minutes early that night, and that still wasn't early enough. 25 years ago this week, on June 23rd, 1996, Austin 316 was born. You believe it's been 25 years? And it's still got to be the highest-selling pro wrestling t-shirt of all time. Right? I mean, it's between that and the NWO shirt. I couldn't go anywhere back then wearing that Austin 316 shirt, which I still have. It'd probably be too big on me now. That was during the phase where I used to buy extra large shirts for some reason. I don't know why. I definitely did not need an extra large. It looked like I could have slept in that thing. So I doubt it would fit me today either. But I would wear that shirt back then. I couldn't go anywhere without getting a reaction. I was crossing the street one day, a few blocks away from my house. I almost shit myself when a truck driver honked at me. He was parked at a red light. I was crossing the street and the driver saw my shirt and he honked. And I almost had a fucking heart attack. If you know those truck horns, they're loud. But when I looked up, the guy was shouting Austin 316 at me, had a big smile on his face. So back then, I knew if I just wanted to go out and be left alone, I would have to leave that shirt at home. Wear my, Bugle Boy shirt or some bullshit like that. The show in Milwaukee sold out 3 weeks in advance. It was the first time since debuting as a pay-per-view that they did not feature the full slate of eight tournament matches, that is, on the actual show. We got the semifinal and final matches only, which saw Steve Austin beat Wildman Mark Marrow. Marrow's boot caught Austin in the mouth on a near fall, and Austin had to get 16 stitches in his upper lip before his second match later in the show. Jake the Snake Roberts beat Vader by disqualification, who then did a number on Jake's ribs, giving him a storyline injury heading into the finals. Ultimate Warrior, his final WWE pay-per-view appearance, picked up a quick win over Jerry Lawler. Boy, Lawler sure does have a knack for having shitty King of the Ring matches, doesn't he? All right, that one in 94 with Piper, which sucked. The match with Bret in 95, which sucked. And this match wasn't much better. They couldn't do much. The Warrior was dealing with a shoulder injury. Let's be honest, even without the injury, it's not like Warrior was going to be doing much anyway in the ring at that point. Mankind beat The Undertaker as cleanly as anybody up to that point had ever beaten The Undertaker, even though there was an accidental urn shot by Paul Bearer. But he put him down with the mandible claw. Mick Foley is on the latest Broken Skull sessions with Steve Austin, and he singled out this match as a turning point in his career because he had only debuted a few months before this, the night after WrestleMania. This was his first big match in WWE, and he just assumed that he was going to be doing the job. You know, he was the latest guy for The Undertaker to feud with, and Undertaker was going to go over. So when Taker told him that he was going over, he was shocked, and he knew he was in for the biggest push of his life. But it was shocking to see The Undertaker lose that cleanly. Ahmed Johnson beat Goldust to win the Intercontinental title. The main thing I always remember from this match was right at the start, Ahmed does this running dive into the corner, out over the top rope onto Goldust, and him coming up a little short and landing right on top of his head, or nearly on top of his head. One of the scariest things I've ever seen. We see dives like that all the time now, but not back then. And you definitely didn't see it from a 250-pound man like Ahmed Johnson. And Austin pinned Jake Roberts with the stunner to win the King of the Ring tournament, a win that was originally meant for Hunter Hearst Helmsley. But the curtain call killed all of that. Helmsley ended up jobbing to Jake Roberts in a qualifying match and was not even on the pay-per-view, although he did beat Aldo Montoya in a dark match that night. So I guess that's something, right? He was in the ring with the guy that had the jockstrap over his face, right? Then came the iconic promo. Austin started heeling on Jake Roberts, who was doing a religious gimmick at that time. He was born again, quoting Bible verses. He even named his new albino python Revelations. And from that came the words, "You sit there and you thump your Bible and you say your prayers and it didn't get you anywhere. Talk about your Psalms, talk about John 3:16. Austin 3:16 says, I just whipped your ass." I would say at that point, a star was born, but you know, people forget, Austin did not become this transcendent figure in wrestling because of this promo. You started to see Austin 3:16 signs popping up in the crowds, but Austin was still a mid-card player until the fall of 96. At SummerSlam, 2 months after this, he was wrestling Yokozuna on the pre-show. It really was the feud that he had with Bret Hart, feuding with a real main eventer, more than this promo that sent him on his way, and then it was the stuff with Mike Tyson and Vince McMahon that just put him over the top and launched him into the stratosphere. But a few years ago on Busted Open Radio, Austin said it was Michael Hayes, after he got all stitched up backstage, who told him that Jake Roberts had cut this religious-based promo on him during the show. And when he asked him, well, what did he say? That's when the Austin 3:16 line popped into his brain, and he also came up with the closing line, and that's the bottom line because Stone Cold said so. He came up with both of those lines on the fly, so that one promo gave him two iconic taglines. That one night at an event that he was never even supposed to win. The stars just happened to align for him, and the pieces all fell into place. And in the main event, Shawn Michaels retained his WWE Championship over the British Bulldog, with Mr. Perfect as the guest referee, handpicked by the Bulldog and Jim Cornette. He was stationed outside the ring with Earl Hebner inside. A much better match than the one they had the month prior at that Beware of Dog pay-per-view, when the power went out and they thought their match was not even airing due to the power outage, until midway through the match, Earl Hebner is like, "Ah, we are back live. We're actually live right now." And then they were pissed because they were just going through the motions. So they had a much better match here. 20 years ago this week, on June 21st, 2001, the debut episode of WWE's new reality show, Tough Enough, premiered on MTV as the top-rated show on cable for the night. Al Snow, Taz, Tori, and Jacqueline served as the trainers for that first season. Maven and Nydia were the male and female winners for season one. Maven, I still maintain, Maven had a good look. Maven had real potential. I think he could have been much bigger than what he turned out to be. But he will always live on in Royal Rumble history with that Undertaker elimination in 2002. One of the great Royal Rumble moments of all time. Chris Nowinski was a runner-up, Harvard Chris. He eventually landed a job in WWE. Then he suffered pretty severe concussion issues that ended his career. And later on, he co-founded the Concussion Legacy Foundation. Josh Lomberger, a.k.a. Josh Matthews, also went on to land a job in WWE. The best parts of that first season were Taz verbally roasting Daryl for being a lazy ass. Even during the reunion, they had a reunion special when the season was over. And I wish I could remember everything he said. He had this great line about, oh God, I don't remember what it was. It was something about like when you're dead and in a box or something, people aren't going to give a shit about you. He called him a bitch. I know that. He called Daryl a bitch. And then Daryl walked off crying. Poor Daryl didn't even know what he was getting himself into. But staying on Tough Enough here for a second, the sixth and final, as of this recording anyway, final season, most recent season of Tough Enough, which aired live from the Performance Center in Orlando, premiered 6 years ago this week on June 23rd, 2015. Josh Brettle and Sarah Lee were the winners, each earning $250,000 contracts with WWE. Josh, who was given the name Bronson Matthews, got a ton of heat in the locker room when he tweeted several months later during an episode of Raw. He tweeted and referred to the Social Outcasts faction. Remember the Social Outcasts? Bo Dallas, Curtis Axel, Adam Rose, and Heath Slater. He referred to them in a hashtag as the Social Jobbers. That didn't go over too well with the WWE locker room. Cody Rhodes said that he was banned from the locker room and to enjoy dressing in the hall. Kevin Owens blocked him on Twitter. He never did make it to TV, and he was cut the following year, said to be more due to concussion issues than his ill-advised tweet. Sarah Lee also never made it to NXT television and was cut a year after her win. She's also married to Wesley Blake of the Forgotten Sons, who WWE apparently forgot until they didn't. Once they realized he was still employed, they released him just a few months ago. Other names from that last season who went on to receive WWE contracts include Chelsea Green, Mandy Rose, Sonya Deville, and the Velveteen Dream, Patrick Clark. We all know how that story turned out. The judges for season 6 were Daniel Bryan, Hulk Hogan, and Paige. Hogan only lasted 5 episodes, though, because his sex tape and N-word scandal exploded a few weeks later, which resulted in WWE terminating him and replacing him in the judges' seat with The Miz. Also 20 years ago, on June 24th, 2001, Edge defeated Rhino and Kurt Angle to become the King of the Ring. The Undertaker beat the crap out of Diamond Dallas Page in, I can't even call it a match. It was a fight. And it did not end well for DDP, who got his ass kicked, tucked his tail, and eventually ran away through the crowd to escape. Kurt Angle and Shane McMahon had a hellacious street fight that was easily the best match on the show. Angle suffered a sprained tailbone, a concussion, needed 5 stitches above his right eye. The concussion actually came earlier in the night in a match with Christian because he was also in the King of the Ring tournament that night. So he was already concussed coming into this match, which is insane. And there's no way that Shane McMahon wasn't concussed here too. I mean, I don't remember them officially announcing that, but when Kurt Angle went to suplex him through that glass, because they had like these glass panels that were part of the set and the staging area. It was supposed to be sugar glass, but Angle claims the person in charge ended up getting a harder type of glass instead of the kind that breaks away easily. Yeah, it didn't break. And Shane landed right on top of his head on the concrete. You could hear the sickening thud of skull on concrete. No way he wasn't concussed. Vince McMahon once said he considered going out there and stopping the match, given all the abuse that his son was taking. And Booker T made his WWE debut, interfering in the Triple Threat main event with Steve Austin, Chris Jericho, and Chris Benoit, dumping Austin onto the announce desk, which led to Austin breaking 3 bones in his back. Not the thing that you want to do on your first night in, injuring the top star and the champion of the company. But accidents happen, and Austin didn't hold him responsible. But this is what led to Austin doing more comedy segments that summer with Kurt Angle and Vince McMahon, because he needed some time out of the ring. I mean, he wasn't totally out of the ring, but he didn't wrestle all that much, and a big part of why was because of the injury. Booker, by the way, was led to believe he broke Austin's hand, which Austin says was not true. It was his back. His hand was never broken. But Bruce Pritchard says that Vince McMahon told him to get Booker to carry Austin's bags. I guess as punishment for injuring Stone Cold, or a way for him to kind of, I don't know, pay it back to Austin. Even though Austin said to him when they spoke eventually, hey, it's no problem, don't worry about it. This is what Pritchard says that Vince McMahon said to him, and you can imagine how that went over. But as Pritchard tells it on Booker, or said, you know, when he was on Booker T's heated conversation show a few years ago, hat tip to Wrestling Inc., by the way, for the transcription. This is Pritchard. I remember calling Booker late at night. I had gotten a call from our owner, Vincent Kennedy McMahon, who suggested I call Book to suggest to him that he should call Steve and make sure Steve is all right, and he should be at Steve's door to carry his bags the next day at the airport. And so I'm like, let me get this straight. You want a fat white guy to call the new black guy and ask him to meet the star white guy and carry his bags through the airport? Okay. So obviously that went over like a fart in church. I was straight up with Book and I just didn't pull any punches and I just told him how it was, man, and where it was coming from and why. And he said, okay, great. I ain't carrying nobody's bag. And he didn't, and I respect him for that. And he respects me for being the one to have made the call and do my job. Austin wasn't the only person banged up. Benoit came into this match with a bad neck injury, and he disappeared for over a year after undergoing surgery with Dr. Youngblood down in Texas, spinal fusion surgery. This was Benoit's last match until July of 2002. And then we had a very interesting three-day period here, speaking of 2002. We'll start 19 years ago this week on June 23rd, 2002. WWE presented its final King of the Ring pay-per-view and its first under the WWE initials from Columbus, Ohio. This marked the arrival of one Brock Lesnar, who beat Test and Rob Van Dam to win the crown, the first stop on his march to the Undisputed title at SummerSlam that year. Kurt Angle beat Hulk Hogan by submission with the ankle lock in the most shocking thing on the entire show. Hogan had never submitted before as a babyface in his career. He did a few times as a heel, but never as a babyface. I mean, not that I can remember, never as a babyface. So him tapping out was a big deal. And in the main event, one of the worst WWE pay-per-view main events of all time, especially when you consider the star power that was involved, The Undertaker retained the Undisputed title over Triple H. This match was a complete bore fest, and it turned into an overbooked mess with ref bumps and a terrible roll-up with the tights hooked by The Undertaker for the win. Couldn't even get a good finish. Undertaker then challenged The Rock, who had come out. He was all the way down the aisleway. Challenged The Rock to come on down to the ring, which he obliged. Rock had I think he had just been brought back to television maybe a week before. He was called back early after Steve Austin walked out. Rock had been gone for a few months filming a movie. Rock comes down to the ring. He lays out Undertaker with a spine buster and a people's elbow. But then Triple H gives him a pedigree before Undertaker then recovers and gives Triple H a chokeslam. And it wasn't until much later that I realized why this match may have been so terrible. I say may have because even without an injury, Triple H was so roided up by this point. He just was not the same wrestler he was before the first quad tear. You know, that's why I say on my show a lot of times I've mentioned the fact that I think the 2000 version of Triple H was peak Triple H in the ring. In my opinion, it's my favorite version of Triple H, the McMahon-Helmsley regime version of Triple H from January of 2000 on. By 2002, he was just so much, physically, so much bigger, and he had had, you know, that major injury that he just wasn't the same. I mean, he was unnaturally big. Now, later in 2002, he ended up having some great matches with Shawn Michaels. But before that, he was just not the same worker. But there was a story behind this. Triple H came into the match with a pretty serious elbow injury that he had operated on 2 days after the show. He had the elbow operated on by Dr. Jim Andrews in Birmingham, the same Dr. Andrews who repaired his torn quad. And the hope was that he would be back in time for the Vengeance pay-per-view the following month for what probably would have been a triple threat match for the title against The Undertaker and The Rock, based on what they did here at the end of this pay-per-view. He ended up not being ready for that match, and instead Kurt Angle took his place, and the three of them went on to have one of the greatest triple threat matches in WWE history. That's one of my favorite matches. I mean, when you think of great triple threats in this company, you think of the WrestleMania 20 main event, you think of Cena, Rollins, and Lesnar from Royal Rumble in 2015, but you need to be thinking of that main event too, from Vengeance. Now, one more note on this show. I vividly remember Chris Jericho freaking the fuck out on the internet fans when this show was over, because Jericho at the time had a website and he had a blog and he would regularly post on the internet. He really was one of the earliest wrestlers to interact with his fans online, and he was fairly active on there. But there was some criticism about his match in the semifinals on this show, which he lost to Rob Van Dam, and he blew a gasket. So I scoured the archives of this vast thing that we call the internet, because I knew that this had to live on somewhere. Obviously, the original page is not up anymore. I don't think the website is up anymore. So I scoured and looked around, and I was able to locate the blog that he posted on his website later that same night. The criticism bothered him so much. He was so gotten to that he posted this diatribe early on the morning of June 24th. It's a little long, but I think it's worth reading in full. It's titled, "Hello, Jackoffs." I guess that's you and me. He says, "All right, I've had it. You want a war? Now you've got one. I'm suffering from a bout of insomnia, so I decided to go on the web and check out the reviews of the King of the Ring from tonight, more specifically on the PW Torch website. After reading what all of you smarks, and believe me, you are all still marks, had to say about my match and the show, I am furious. Everybody has the right to an opinion, and here's mine. I am sick of all you holier-than-thou pompous jackasses. That's it. That's all. Baby goes to sleep now. I had one of my best matches of the year tonight with RVD that featured 20 minutes of tremendous action, innovative false finishes, and an absolutely tremendous crowd. It was everything I could have asked for in a match, and it was, in my opinion, an off-the-charts performance from RVD and myself, match of the year caliber. I was so excited about the contest and can humbly state that we stole the show. The crowd was so into it that they were burned out after we went on and quiet for the next 3 to 4 matches. They ate up every move from start to finish and they enjoyed the hell out of it. But now I read the opinions of some of you. Many of you state that the match was very good or excellent. I agree. But many others are saying that the match was slow and predictable, with one jackass even saying it was one of the worst matches of my career. How can you honestly say that? What the hell do you people want? What is it that you're looking for? We go out there and we bust our asses to entertain you. And if the Columbus fans were quiet, they sure as hell weren't during my match. They were entertained. And your thoughts were that bad? Well, if you didn't like my match tonight, then you are out of luck if you're a Jericho fan. Because it was the best you're going to get, jerky. That was CJ at his finest. Wrestling at its finest. A great 4.5-star performance with a tremendous build, a great crowd, and an awesome match. If you didn't like it, then stop watching me and stop watching the WWE and take up bowling, because you will never like anything that we give you. I'm the first one to admit when my performance is not up to snuff or when something was bad, and I'm the most self-critical person on the WWE roster. But tonight's performance was me at my finest. Didn't like it? Get the F out. And good riddance to you. For all of you that enjoyed my match, I say thanks. For those that didn't like it, I don't care, because I'm through with you. And here's the best part of this, especially in hindsight. I am now finished with the internet. And I'm finished with this site because I hate what you marks are doing. You've spoiled it for me. Your negativity is ridiculous. You all come off like a bunch of bitter know-it-alls who won't be happy with anything we give you. Nothing is ever good enough, and quite frankly, I'm over it. You are the same people that are saying that Attack of the Clones is boring, analyzing every little detail instead of allowing yourselves to be entertained by its magic. It seems that some of you wish the wrestling business would dry up and die, because some of you dislike everything we do. Is it always good? No. But we are killing ourselves to try to entertain you, and if you don't respect that, then kiss my ass. I want the business to be around forever, and I am doing my part to keep it great, and I did that tonight, no matter what any of you think. A lot of the boys pandered to you on their websites, asking for your input and your thoughts, and I used to be one of them. But guess what? Not anymore. Think what you want. I don't care. Do what you want. I don't care. Respond how you want, because I won't be reading. I don't give a damn about what you think anymore. One of the best wrestlers in the world and one of the performers in the best match of the night and match of the year candidate from the King of the Ring, signed, Chris Jericho. Well, I love how he was finished with the internet until he started a podcast many years later on that same internet. I guess he had a change of heart. Jericho did indeed continue to post on the message board forums on his website, which he was known to post on, but not nearly as often. He was not posting nearly as often as he had done before his little rant here. For the record, I thought he and RVD did have the best match on the entire pay-per-view, and it was a very good match. Maybe not to the level that he describes it, but it was still very good. 24 hours later, on June 24th, 2002, Bret the Hitman Hart suffered a stroke after falling off of his bicycle, hitting a pothole in Calgary, and flipping forward over the handlebars at a relatively high rate of speed, landed on his back and on the back of his head. This was only a few days before his 45th birthday. Suffered a blood clot on the right side of his brain that caused temporary paralysis on the left side of his body. He was not wearing a helmet. As a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, I believe he was on his way to pick up his helmet. I guess maybe his helmet needed to be repaired. Maybe it was the strap or something. I don't know, but I could have sworn that he was actually headed to the bike shop to retrieve his helmet, but he suffered a pretty bad landing and a pretty bad stroke, which makes his recovery all the more impressive. The fact that, if you know, you look at him today and you would never even know that he suffered a stroke. I mean, there might be little ticks and stuff, you know, for all we know that maybe he notices, but he really did make a miraculous recovery for someone who was at first totally bedridden. Like I said, paralyzed on one side, didn't know what the future would hold for himself. And it was a pretty serious situation. I think Vince McMahon was one of the first people, I think, to call and check on him, you know, when he got the news about what had happened. And in any event, it was a very serious thing. I remember hearing about that at the time and you know, being very sad. He had already retired. You know, Bret had the concussion issues. And you know, a lot of people think that the concussion issues is really what led to the stroke. And at least at the time, I think doctors were of the mindset that they don't believe that it was due to the concussions. And I think Bret has a history of stroke that runs in his family. His mother, before she passed away, had suffered a series of strokes in her final days. So whatever it was that caused it, he was still a relatively young guy. Like I said, a few days shy of his 45th birthday. And this guy just flies, you know, ass over and lands on his head and suffers a stroke that could very well have ended his life. And all things considered, he made a miraculous recovery. But just one day after that, on June 25th, 2002, at the SmackDown taping in Chicago, a young man by the name of John Cena made his WWE television debut, answering Kurt Angle's open challenge and uttering the words, "Ruthless Aggression," which was a catchphrase that Vince McMahon had mentioned on TV around this time. Actually, it may have been the night before, on Monday Night Raw. This was the beginning of the Ruthless Aggression era. Angle won the match, but Cena made an impression on The Undertaker, who congratulated him in the back after the match, even though Undertaker was a heel at that time. So that was quite the seal of approval from the dead man, which I guess didn't make much of a difference, given that Cena was almost released a few months later. Boy, how things might have been very, very different if they didn't have a John Cena to rely on so heavily for so many years. I mean, you could think of the pros and cons of them not having to rely for so long on John Cena, but believe me, WWE would have been in a lot of trouble if they didn't have a John Cena and couldn't find anybody else to get over the way that Cena did a few years later. Maybe it would have been somebody else. Maybe it would have been Randy Orton. Maybe, you know, Batista could have been elevated a little bit more. I don't know. Cena had a certain level of charisma that those guys just don't have. At least not back then. I think Batista today is actually a pretty charismatic guy. But the Batista from back then was very different than the Hollywood Batista of today. So I think things worked out pretty well for all parties involved. 18 years ago this week on the June 23rd, 2003 episode of Monday Night Raw. Raw was live from Madison Square Garden with Shawn Michaels and Kevin Nash teaming up for a win over Ric Flair and Randy Orton, representing Evolution. Goldberg, making his MSG debut, defeated Rodney Mack in a white boy challenge. Rodney Mack had been doing these 5-minute challenges on TV with different white jobbers for a few weeks. I remember one where he wrestled two white boys at once, and Lillian Garcia introduced the match as a double white boy challenge, because when one does not want one white boy, I guess you go to McDonald's and you order a double with extra cheese. I guess that's how it works. That is, until he got to Goldberg. And, well, he found the one white boy that he couldn't beat. And that was the end of the white boy challenge. And in the main event, Triple H defeated Kane to retain the World Heavyweight Championship. And per the stipulation, Kane was forced to unmask. This was the unmasking of Kane. They teased it out for a while before he finally pulled the mask off, and off came his hair too, which was attached to the mask. It was a wig. When he turned around, he had half his head shaved, and the makeup he was wearing was smeared all over his face from the sweat. I guess nobody really thought that through. He looked a lot like the Missing Link, and maybe even a little bit like this dentist guy that I remember from many years ago who wrestled Bret Hart. I don't think there's any connection between the two. Could just be a coincidence. No burns. There were no burns on his face, which they explain later by the fact that he only thought he was burned for all those years. His scars were not physical, they were psychological. Like me, after years of watching Monday Night Raw. I was not a fan of unmasking Kane, but they did do a good job for a while. They put the black towel on his head, and they would lead him to the ring in chains like an animal. They kept him as a monster, but once that ran its course, I don't know. I just preferred him with the mask, and he eventually started wearing one again. Masked Kane is still the best Kane. When I say masked Kane, I don't mean in the later years. I'm talking about 97 through like 2001. It's my favorite version of Kane. 14 years ago this week, on June 25th, 2007, the biggest tragedy in the history of the wrestling business makes mainstream news as the bodies of Chris Benoit, his wife Nancy, and their 7-year-old son Daniel are discovered in their home by the Fayetteville County Sheriff's Department in Georgia. They were prompted by WWE officials to do a wellness check, which is why they discovered the bodies. Benoit had no-showed the Vengeance Night of Champions pay-per-view the night before, where he was scheduled to wrestle for, and I believe win, the vacant ECW championship against CM Punk. It was very unlike Benoit to no-show an appearance, especially on a live pay-per-view, because he had told people days earlier that Nancy and Daniel were sick, and he had to rush home. It's chilling just thinking back to the idea that this is what he was telling people. Like, he knew, but this is what he was telling people. His body was found hanging from a pulley, using a cord from his weight machine as a noose around his neck, which is not a pleasant way to take one's life, I would not imagine. Nancy's body was found wrapped in a towel with her hands and feet bound. She had been strangled and very badly beaten. Their son was also asphyxiated, found in his bedroom. Both had Bibles placed next to their bodies, and Benoit was not the religious type, but they both had Bibles beside them. It was later determined that Benoit killed his wife and son and then himself in a double murder-suicide. The killings happened over a three-day period that weekend, with Nancy first being killed on Friday, Daniel being killed on Saturday, and then Benoit killing himself on Sunday, but not before trying, even after he had just killed two people, to book a flight to get to Texas for the pay-per-view. He was trying to make the show, or at least thinking about trying to make the show. The thought of him actually going through with it, you imagine if he flew in for the pay-per-view and wrestled with his family dead at home? It's horrifying. Nancy's sister, Sandra, said that the medical examiner told the family that Chris would very likely have been dead anyway within 10 months. His heart was three times the normal size, was ready to blow up at any moment. She blamed steroids and prescription drugs for him doing what he did. In fact, there's a photo of Benoit in Dr. Phil Aston's office the same day that he killed Nancy, just hours before. Aston said that he had prescribed testosterone for Benoit. Aston's office was later raided, and he admitted to illegally prescribing drugs many times without even examining his patients first, and pleaded guilty to all 175 counts against him before being sentenced to 10 years in prison. Tests concluded that Benoit's brain was so riddled with CTE, it looked like the brain of an 80-year-old Alzheimer's patient. The same day the bodies were discovered, WWE was to have presented a tribute to Mr. McMahon during a three-hour edition of Monday Night Raw. This was after the limo explosion angle. They even flew in Vince's brother, Rod. Rod McMahon was going to make his first ever appearance on WWE television, but for obvious reasons, the show was canceled, and they scrapped the entire angle. Fans were greeted instead when they tuned into USA Network by Vince McMahon standing in the middle of the ring in an empty arena, letting everybody know what had happened and that instead they would be paying tribute to the life and career of Chris Benoit. By the next day, once it was clear, what had likely happened here, Vince McMahon's tune changed. And he opened that night's episode of ECW on Sci-Fi with a very different statement that there would be no mentions of Chris Benoit. And in fact, his name has never been mentioned again on WWE television in the 14 years since. And the fact that you still occasionally, it doesn't happen a lot, thankfully, but the fact that you still, even occasionally, have people asking if Chris Benoit is ever going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. You know, I hear Jim Ross even, and other people in wrestling on their podcasts will talk about how they get asked on Twitter and stuff. Oh, when will Chris Benoit go into the Hall of Fame? If enough time has gone by, will Chris Benoit be inducted into the Hall of Fame? Or even suggesting that they want to see him inducted into the Hall of Fame. All that shows is that Benoit is not the only one here suffering from brain damage. I remember exactly where I was when I learned of the news. I'm sure a lot of you probably remember as well. I was at work. I was getting ready to leave to go home to watch Raw. to watch this funeral, this memorial service for Vince McMahon. And right before I left the office, I went, it must have been either the Observer site or PW Insider, one of those sites. And there it was, staring me right back in the face, in the headline. Chris Benoit and family found dead. And my jaw dropped. I clicked on the story, and I could not believe what I was reading. I was just sitting there in just stunned silence for 20 or 30 seconds. It didn't seem real. And my first thought, once I processed the news and I realized, oh my God, this is a real story. Honest to God, the first thought that ran through my head was not murder-suicide. It was not that even the family was, you know, burglarized and they were all slaughtered or anything like that. The first thing I thought of, because you hear about stories like this sometimes, I thought it was carbon monoxide poisoning. I thought the family was home. They either didn't have an alarm or it didn't go off. There was a leak. And they all, you know, died in their sleep. I couldn't even conceive of the idea that it was a murder-suicide type of situation. And I didn't even know Benoit. So imagine how his friends and colleagues felt when they got the news. People who knew him, people who maybe knew his family or had met his wife or his son before. I mean, it was the most shocking thing that I had ever heard about in all my years of being a wrestling fan. And it was a turning point for the company that really forced them to shore up their wellness policy, which had more holes in it than Swiss cheese. I mean, they implemented it after Eddie Guerrero passed away, and it was better than nothing. It was a good program, but it was not as strong, not nearly as strong as it is today. Once the Benoit stuff happened, that's when it felt like that's really when they got super serious about it. And even now, it's not a perfect system, I'm sure. But this is what really got them to kind of get their act together and say, okay, we've got to start taking this shit seriously. The following year, the company went PG. They banned chair shots to the head. They banned choking. I mean, it was a huge black eye for the wrestling business and for WWE, especially the way that some of the talent responded. They would send out talent for interviews on these cable TV shows. This is when Nancy Disgrace and all those other fucking losers were having wrestlers on their shows every night just to try to pop a rating. They knew nothing about wrestling, so to hear them talk about it, you know, and then, for example, was it Nancy Disgrace? I forgot who it was. They had, I think it was her, they had the list. They had the list of all the wrestlers, all the young wrestlers that passed away in their 30s and their 40s, their early 50s, from steroids and drugs and heart attacks. But I'm looking at this list, and you had people on that list like Owen Hart. And I think they lumped in a bunch of other names too. It's like, the moment that you've lumped in Owen Hart on that list, on a list that is meant to show drug deaths and things of that nature, you've instantly lost all credibility. They had an intern go on the internet and put together a list of all the dead wrestlers and give it to me. But this was going on every night for weeks. It was like a fucking circus. But a lot of the guys who went on television, and Ken Kennedy was one of them, did not exactly make themselves look good in their appearances. And as more information came out about some of the stuff that Benoit was doing and the drugs and the steroids and stuff, again, it was just a huge black eye for the company, huge black eye for the industry. And I don't care, you know, how good of a wrestler Chris Benoit was or what drugs he was taking. Drugs, by the way, that he chose to take. Nobody forced them down his throat. Nobody forced those needles into his ass. He made that choice. His wife and son were not given a choice. He killed two people in brutal fashion, especially his wife. Her injuries were horrific. And it's still hard to reconcile, all these years later, how any of this could have happened. 13 years ago this week, on June 23rd, 2008, WWE hosted its draft lottery on Monday Night Raw from San Antonio, Texas. The biggest move being Triple H, who was WWE champion at the time, being moved along with the title from Raw to SmackDown. The other move that made headlines was Jim Ross being moved off the Raw announced team with Jerry Lawler over to the SmackDown brand. Lawler stayed on Raw, but JR was moved over to SmackDown with Mick Foley, who had just started as an announcer on the brand. Michael Cole, in turn, was moved from SmackDown to Raw, which began the Cole era of Monday Night Raw. And the move caught JR by surprise. He was not happy about it, especially after specifically asking Kevin Dunn at the hotel bar the night before if he was being moved. He just went and asked him point blank. And he was told, no. According to JR's book, Under the Black Hat, Dunn told him, are you kidding? You think we're stupid enough to break up our Madden and Summerall? John Madden and Pat Summerall being the most revered broadcast duo in NFL history. Now, is it possible that Kevin Dunn was telling the truth as he knew it to be at that moment and the decision was made by Vince McMahon at the last minute? It's possible. But it's equally possible he was lying through his fucking teeth. In retrospect, JR knew he fucked up because he had posted a blog leading into the show that week that he did not, you know, in his blog he mentioned that he did not want to move to SmackDown and he didn't think it would be prudent to waste a draft pick on an announcer. So he pretty much sealed his fate when he said that because it got back to Vince and he gave somebody a reason, whoever that person was, be funny if it was Kevin Dunn, to get in Vince's ear and instigate him and say, hey, you should make, you know, look what this guy is saying. We got to make an example out of good old JR. Just to fuck with him. God knows they made a whole fucking career out of doing that. Now, yeah, JR got paid really well for it. But you can come up with a laundry list of examples of all the times the WWE and Vince McMahon fucked with Jim Ross for their own amusement. This was one of those times. So they lied to him. And then they ambushed him live on the air so they could get his genuine reaction to the news. They put a camera right in his face. All he could do is shake his head. You could tell how angry he was. He contemplated quitting. He was up all night until 6 a.m. on the phone with his wife, Jan. He didn't even have another suit to wear for the SmackDown taping the next night. And in the end, he decided not to quit. He said that's not a word that his father taught him. Wasn't going to quit. And he did go to SmackDown. His run lasted into the following year, the following fall, which is longer than Mick Foley lasted at the desk. He survived all of 4 months until he just couldn't take Vince McMahon yelling in his one good ear anymore. This was also the night of Vince McMahon's the final installment of Vince McMahon's Million Dollar Mania gimmick that he was doing at the time, where Vince himself would give away $1 million every week, trying to give the show a ratings boost, which is all this was. It was a ratings, an attempt to boost the ratings, which didn't even work. Bruce Pritchard claims the money came right out of Vince's personal bank account, because for some reason it couldn't come out of the company. It was, I would say, an entertaining train wreck for the 3 weeks that it lasted. I remember the 1 week where he got Rickrolled. It may have actually been the very first week. It might have been the first winner they picked. The guy Rickrolled him. And then when he finally answered the phone, Vince didn't hear him because he took forever to say hello and answer the phone. Vince McMahon couldn't hear him and he hung up on the guy. That's $200,000 that guy could have lost. Thankfully for him, Vince called back a second time. He got Rickrolled a second time. You know, I say Rickrolled. It was one of these things where some people have it set up where when you call them, it can play music first until the person comes to the phone to answer the phone. And the song that this guy chose was Rick Astley, Never Gonna Give You Up. So this was the second time now that this played on Monday Night Raw. Finally, though, the guy answered the phone. By the way, I'm sure Vince McMahon was probably one of the only people in the building that night who didn't even realize what was going on. He probably never even heard of a Rick Roll before. You may be listening to this right now and not know what a Rickroll is because it kind of passed years ago, but it used to be a thing. Maybe it still is, I don't know. But the person did get on the phone. He gave the password that you're supposed to give, and he won the money. The new password, by the way, was their brand new catchphrase at that time. WWE Universe. They had just introduced it. They were trying to get that over. Here we are. 14 fucking years later, or 13 years later, whatever it is. Still with the WWE Universe. We can't call them fans. And we can't call them marks, even though we'd love to. So we'll call them the WWE Universe. There was another week where he dialed the person who answered, and he said to Vince McMahon, he goes, "Oh, wrong number." And he hung up on Vince. And then the great Khali, who was out there with Vince, got very upset, and he starts yelling some gibberish into the phone. This was a fucking train wreck. By the way, Vince McMahon dials the phone about as fast as my grandfather does, and he's been dead for 25 years. Anyway, this was the last installment, as I mentioned. He gave away $500,000 to one lucky fan on this final night, and then all of a sudden, after giving away this money, the stage began to collapse. It began to implode under his feet, and a portion of the McMahon's Million Dollar Mania set, this giant sign, this steel sign that they had on the side of the stage, very conveniently tipped over right on top of Vince. Sparks flew. Wrestlers, including Triple H, rushed over like it was a chute to try to rescue him from under the debris, which really wasn't on top of him. It was kind of like covering him, shielding him. I laughed the entire time at how hokey this all was. But I guess they needed some way to end this silly gimmick. He didn't want to give away any of his money since it wasn't doing anything to really move the ratings. He's like, fuck this, I'm not going to give away money if people aren't watching my show. So this was their way of ending things. Vince kept calling Triple H Paul to make it feel real. Paul! Paul, I can't feel my legs, Paul! There was absolutely no follow-up to this, outside of it being a way to write him off television until the following year. Also 13 years ago, on June 25th, 2008, the Ultimate Warrior wrestled the final match of his career in front of 12,000 people against Orlando Jordan for the NWE promotion in Barcelona, Spain. His wife and little warrior daughters were in the crowd to watch him, which may have been the reason he did the match and took the booking. Maybe he wanted his kids to see him wrestle one time. Because I don't believe he had wrestled a match since probably the Halloween Havoc match in 98 with Hulk Hogan, which is better left forgotten. So it had been about a decade since his last match. He was not moving around well. You can find video of the entire thing on YouTube. He was not moving around well. He ran to the ring, and when I say ran, I'm being very generous when I say that. Clearly, he was dealing with knee issues. Honestly, you could even see it years later at the Hall of Fame when he came out on Raw the night before he died. When he would just walk to the ring. He had some kind of knee problem. I don't know if he ever had a knee replacement or what. I don't think we ever got the full story on what the knee problems were, but he was walking real funky. And he got to the ring after his entrance. He was gasping for air. But he worked for 18 minutes. 18 minutes. An 18-minute Ultimate Warrior match in 2008. He was doing moves that he never did in his heyday in WWE. He did a superplex. He did a cross body off the top rope. He won with a diving shoulder block off the ropes to capture the NWE championship, which he promptly relinquished before retiring for good. 10 years ago this week, on June 27th, 2011, with his contract expiring the following month and no plans to re-sign with WWE, CM Punk dropped his famous pipe bomb on an episode of Raw Roulette, live from Las Vegas. a promo that I had at number 3 on my list of the top 9 greatest promos in WWE history that I did on the podcast about 5 years ago. A promo that is still relevant today. Stone Cold Steve Austin, who knows a thing or two about iconic promos, was watching and he tweeted later that night, CM Punk just melted my 52-inch TV, 52 inches, with a scorching hot promo. Delivery, content, and attitude, one of the best promos I've ever seen. Punk was frustrated. WWE had recently disbanded the Straight Edge Society that he was leading on SmackDown. He wasn't doing much of anything on television. Then he got a couple of big wins on TV, including one over John Cena. And he earned himself a WWE Championship match right as WWE was trying to sign him to a new deal. Oh, how convenient. How convenient that his contract was expiring. They wanted him to sign a new one, and WWE all of a sudden took an interest in CM Punk. It's like, oh shit, this guy might leave. We should probably do something with him. But Punk was fed up. He was also fed up that The Rock had already been slotted in for next year's WrestleMania main event when he himself had never been in one. So they acknowledged on TV that his contract was set to expire at midnight on July 17th, and teased that Punk might just win the title at Money in the Bank and leave with it. Now, the main event on this show was a tables match between John Cena and R-Truth. Punk interfered, he cost Cena the match, he grabbed the mic, he walked all the way up to the stage, sat down, and cut a scathing promo on the company that was more of a shoot promo masquerading as a storyline. Here on this show, a lot of truth in this promo. He talked about being a Paul Heyman guy. Paul Heyman was not in the company at that time. He teased taking the WWE title with him after he wins it to New Japan or maybe even back to Ring of Honor. He gave Colt Cabana a shout out. He called out Vince McMahon's imaginary brass rings that he always dangles in front of talent. He said Vince surrounds himself by douchebag yes men like John Laurinaitis. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And that he would like to think that WWE would be better after Vince McMahon is dead. But it's just going to be taken over by his idiotic daughter and his doofus son-in-law and the rest of his stupid family. Although not if Nick Khan has anything to say about that. And then before he could share a personal story about Vince McMahon and WWE's anti-bullying campaign, which I am still waiting to hear the story. Maybe there was no story. Maybe, he knew where he was going to get cut off, I guess. But before he had the chance to tell us this story, they cut his mic. And with that, Punk talked himself into his first WWE title run and a lucrative new contract. A man who had every intention of walking out would go on to hold that title later on for 434 days. And while things turned out nicely for him and he met his future wife working for the company, a lot of good things happened for CM Punk. It is still baffling how badly they bungled those next 2 or 3 months after he won the title of Money in the Bank. As hot and over as he was at that time, he could have been so much bigger. They rushed him back way too soon. And they, frankly, it's not just a matter of, oh, I think he could have been bigger. They could have just made this, they could have gotten more creative with this. It could have been even more fun than it was. They rushed him back way too soon, instead of milking him making appearances with the belt in various places. They had Alberto Del Dipshit cash in on him at SummerSlam and win the title. They set up, of all things, a CM Punk Kevin Nash match out of that. Punk, I think, ended up getting powerbombed on television a bunch of times without ever getting a receipt on Nash because they never did the match. Nash had to pull out because of a medical issue. So Triple H took his place and went on to pin the white-hot CM Punk with the pedigree. I think it took 3 of them, but still. Triple H beat CM Punk. Because of course he did. Then Punk won the title back, And you could probably count on one hand how many pay-per-views he actually headlined as the champion. At least until he turned heel. Things improved on that front once he turned heel. He at least got a few main events before he dropped the belt to The Rock. But despite all of that, he did become a much bigger star out of this. And that really, I think, as much as anything he actually said, any words that he spoke in the promo, that is what makes this one of the greatest promos in WWE history. And 2 years ago this week, on June 27th, 2019, WWE named Paul Heyman as the new executive director of Monday Night Raw, and Eric Bischoff as the new executive director of SmackDown, head of the show's move to Fox later that year in October, with both men reporting directly to Vince McMahon. The moves came in light of weakening ticket sales and television ratings, and at least in part due to AEW securing television with TNT. They were starting to make moves, and that was making people in WWE, I'm sure, a little bit nervous. Investors started to ask questions on some of the conference calls about not just AEW, but the falling ratings. And they saw Bischoff and Heyman as two names that people associate with that glory period of pro wrestling. So they decided to install them in positions of power. Bischoff moved his family from Wyoming all the way to Connecticut for the new job. And 4 months later, he was fired and replaced by Bruce Pritchard. Heyman lasted a little bit longer, at least. He was fired from the role exactly 1 year later. But they kept him around as an on-air performer. And that is this week, this very busy week in wrestling history. Keep emailing me your questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. You can follow me on Twitter as well, @solomonster. And don't forget, memberships are open on the YouTube channel if you want to go check that out and some of the perks that you get for joining and becoming a member, including the official Discord. I'm going to be back with you for episode 711. How about that? 711. Coming up on July the 4th, Independence Day edition of the podcast next week. We'll see if I can get through the show noise-free without all of the pyro and fireworks and explosions going off outside my window. And that's the one thing I don't miss when I had my cat before she died. This poor cat would be traumatized every year. Every July 4th, I felt so bad. I would imagine if you have like a dog or a cat, they probably go through the same thing. Just the constant fireworks and everything that's being set off outside every July 4th, and she'd end up under the bed. I wouldn't see her for about 4 days after that. But yeah, it is July 4th next weekend. There will be a podcast, even though it is a holiday weekend. So I look forward to being back with you then for all the latest news and history and maybe even some of your questions. Maybe I'll be able to squeeze them in next week. But I do read everything you guys send me. Until then, be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great week. Join me live on the YouTube channel after Dynamite, back in its normal slot on Wednesday, and of course back next weekend for 7-Eleven. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
If you're a Kendo Stick fan, you're in luck. For all the themed and gimmick shows this company has, I'm surprised WWE hasn't given us Kendo Stick pay-per-view. All Kendo Sticks. Kendo Stick on a pole. You can hang the Kendo Sticks from the ceiling in a ladder match. You can put the Kendo Sticks at the end of the aisleway. You hide the Kendo Sticks strategically in different parts of the building. Oh, they can have a lot of fun with this. I just came up with that off the top of my head. WWE Kendo Stick. The most overused prop in all of wrestling.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.